This is Chapter a Day. I'm Susan Sweeney. We're reading from Our Lady of Perpetual Hunger, a memoir from Chef Lisa Donovan. After coming out the other end of the darkest time with her abusive ex, Philip, the father of her son Joseph, Lisa has fallen in love with her college art teacher, John Donovan. She, John, Joseph, and her cat, Sonny, are on their way to a new life in Nashville, where Lisa has been hired as an art teacher at a private girls' school. Our Lady of Perpetual Hunger, Chapter 6. John, Joseph, and I moved to Nashville at the end of the summer in 2002. We rented a house off 12th Avenue South, a neighborhood that was built around a large park immortalizing a significant Civil War battle, and was, when we arrived, known for prostitution and drug deals, and as a scouting location for Harmony Korine movie extras. That neighborhood now looks a lot like a wealthy suburb, fancy shops with $55 tea towels that say, "Bless your heart," and restaurant chains selling $15 tacos with very suspect ingredients like ancho mayo sauce or green chili tapenade that only white suburbanites who don't know any better will pay for. Bless their hearts. When we lived there, though, it was still the place where broke musicians and songwriters and artists rented from people who owned property they were praying would pay off someday. The houses were nice and affordable. The landlords were patient and gracious. John set up a studio in the basement and worked several odd jobs hanging art at local museums or in the airport or making frames at a frame shop. Joseph started daycare at a co-op where I felt connected and where he felt comfortable, and I started my job teaching art history, fundamental 2D art, and photography. I wrote artist features for a zine out of Brooklyn, and every once in a while, art reviews for local shows in Nashville. We ate a lot of black beans, couscous bought in bulk, and sautéed spinach. A lot of it. I was too busy figuring out that teaching at an obnoxiously wealthy and very conservative high school was not my cup of tea to be engaged in any real cooking, much less baking. So we continued being skinny and hungry, but not out of sadness or grief. We were happy and eager. At night, we would put Joseph to bed together, reading Harry Potter or stories from an old Native American folklore book that John had from graduate school, and then I would sing him songs, the songs I had been singing to him his whole life, in a room we decorated with Batman and Bob the Builder paraphernalia. Then John and I would have tea on the couch while Sonny slept between us, and we would talk about art and books and the work we wanted to do, how we never wanted to retire, but how we wanted to build a life where we would wake up in the morning, have coffee with each other, go to our respective corners in the house, him to a studio and me to a writer's desk, and just work, meeting again for lunch and then later for wine. This was our simple dream. We would listen to Miles Davis's Kind of Blue or Beck's Sea Change or Yo La Tengo's Summer Sun while we planned and schemed about the kind of world we knew we could finally build together, all while my son slept safely in a room I paid for with my own money from my own hard work. We tucked into Nashville and we tucked into one another, all three of us madly in love, with no one to tell us that we weren't good enough or that we weren't doing it right. And when they did, because some did, we didn't have to listen because we had each other and we knew better. Even though we weren't sure how it would happen, we knew this was it, our lives ready to unfurl in front of us. This was always meant to be. This was what we had both deserved our whole lives. On a little street off 12th Avenue South in Nashville, Tennessee, while dogs howled in Sevier Park across the street and Civil War ghosts slipped between houses, the Donovan family started. boldly and beautifully ready for anything that came our way, willing to risk it all for what we knew it could be. We had nothing to lose, literally, except for some Bob the Builder sheets and each other, and we knew we would never leave each other's side. So onward and eventually upward we went, toward something more, something right, something correct, toward ourselves. I married John Donovan in a stained glass cathedral on St. Charles in New Orleans, across from Audubon Park, on a deservedly beautiful spring day, with four-year-old Joseph sporting a black eye and a tuxedo holding our rings by my side, and me with a folded-up picture of a person we had not yet met tucked into the bodice of my dress. We were engaged in October. We set out making plans for a sweet, small ceremony with our family and a few friends in the city we loved. In February, 5 weeks before our wedding, we learned we would be four, and a doctor printed out a picture of the person in my womb, the picture I tucked into the silk lining of my dress, who would be Maggie Donovan. My pregnancy with Maggie Donovan was full of romance and excitement. Sharing that time with a man I loved and who loved me was supremely wonderful. He cared for me in small ways, always made sure my legs were rubbed at night, always made sure my favorite kind of yogurt was in the refrigerator, always spent meaningful time with Joseph's so I could take long showers and have restful pauses. We were deeply in love. We couldn't keep it to ourselves. We felt exhaustively lucky. Just lucky as hell. There was not a single doubt about where we found ourselves. We knew we had made it to the right place. We were each other's place. And as much as that pregnancy was not one of solitude, it was also not a pregnancy of carbohydrate indulgence or nostalgia. I did not have the same impulses during my pregnancy with Maggie as I did with Joseph. I baked, sure, but eventually came back to it out of necessity, if I'm being really honest. It was purely economics. Right around this time, I realized that no one in Nashville baked, and that small things like birthday cakes were a niche market. I did a few for coworkers and parents at Joseph's daycare. It was mostly a side project. We had new horizons. I was building a life with a person who didn't balk when I showed him my writing and said I wanted to do more. And I believed in his work, sculpture that was winning awards in South Korea, his dedication perpetually inspiring and motivating. His knowledge and engagement in the world of clay was a playbook for me in how to build a career. We were strongly focused on putting food on the table and keeping the lights on, while we aimed for these far-off places. Raising our family while we took our aim was the work we wanted to get right first. It took us a minute to figure out that dance. The offspring of the wealthy and conservative at the private girls' high school made me distraught. I, in my immature 24 years of life, did not know what to do with myself. I wanted to teach about the radical Judy Chicago and the ever-stalwart Richard Serra in the same reverential terms, putting radical early feminism, which no high school teacher ever talked about, on an equal pedestal to that dying 20th century stoicism and work ethic mostly attributed to men, which was so prevalent in history books. I wanted to talk about how important art was to religion, to building it up and breaking it down in equal measure. I wanted to talk about drag queens and outsider cultures and David Bowie and Valeska Gert and performance art and Jesco White and how it all came from something real and raw about being human at a certain point in human history. I took them to junkyards to study Louise Nevelson, to build things out of trash, leftovers, scraps from the working world, make refuse into something new and beautiful with basic tools and their hands. I spent too much time in that job pontificating, perched on a soapbox in the most desperate way, shouting about how the kids in my room were not doing their jobs correctly if they were just regurgitating everything their parents told them to be true, if they were limiting their scope to the disjointed way they were being raised, to not see or feel what the rest of the world might be going through, to assume that the world is important only as far as their own inexperienced eyes could see. How can you be 17 and not have every single idea in your head all at once, I would shout, in order to dig through it to find what you truly believe? How can you not question everything? I had a soft spot for a few of the kids, mostly the ones who were there on scholarships, the ones who got bussed in, and I tried really hard to teach to them. I promise I did. But getting so close to that fire was too much for me. It was the beginning of the end when a girl, a good student, and someone I'd been impressed with up to that point, came into my classroom sobbing, shielded and caressed by her best friend. I gently escorted her and her friend out of my room to find out what was wrong. Did she want to talk about it? Did she absolutely not want to talk about it? Did she just need to sit in my office for the day? How could I help? I thought someone must have died. I really did. She was crying so hard she could not make words. I hugged her and stroked her hair and then looked at her friend quizzically. Is everything okay? Does she need to go home? And her friend said, in a very simple and mournful tone, Oh, Miss Ryerson, her father had been promising her an Audi SUV, and she got the family's used Volvo instead. Can you believe it? My eye immediately started twitching in a way it never had before, but in a way that it would forever afterward when faced with the utter bull that I knew I was going to have to try to stay measured in the face of. I said the words before my brain had the good sense to stop them. Are you kidding me? I pushed the girl from my embrace, went back into my classroom where 21 other students were waiting, and said, Everyone on their feet, now! I walked back out to the two girls in the hallway who were now looking confused and maybe a little scared and said, Field trip! Everyone follow me right now! I walked all 23 of them out to the faculty parking lot, one that always looked markedly different from the student parking lot, full of new and slightly used luxury vehicles, all freshly polished, with future alma mater stickers on the bumpers. Because when you're rich, you know exactly what school you get to go to even before you apply. The faculty lot was full of used, unwashed cars with coffee mug stains on the dashboards and of vintages several years older than the kids staring at them, with dents and dings, and one with a spare tire that needed to be replaced weeks earlier. That was mine, the one with the spare I could not replace. I walked them to that car. In case you aren't clear about how the other 95% of the world lives, here is my car. In the back, you will see that my son's car seat is locked in. So this is also the car I drive my child around in. I drive this car daily to come teach you kids and make about enough money to put gas in it and pay my half of the rent and can only really afford to buy an amount of food that means I usually just eat my son's leftovers. I then handed the keys to the newly sweet 16 girl and said, Here, take it for a spin around the parking lot, won't you? She took the keys and tried to get in through the driver's side. No. You actually have to climb in through the passenger side, sweetheart. That door hasn't worked in years. It's fine. You're young and limber. She walked up to me, started crying again because I was straight up bullying her at this point, handed me my keys and said, I am so sorry, Miss Ryerson. I am so sorry. All I could bring myself to say was, You are better than thinking you deserve every single thing you want already. Get back to class and get to work. For most of the rest of that year, I tried to avoid giving any more lectures about class and wealth disparity and the disenfranchisement of everyone who was not a very upper-class white suburbanite, spending their whole life existing within a 10-mile radius of people who look and act just like them. I saw that year out, learned how to keep my opinions to myself, and I stayed in touch with some deeply good students with whom I made real connections, and then I gladly left to find work that I might be better tempered for. That was when baking re-entered my life. After I decided I could easily replace the paltry $26,000 per year that I was making at the high school in ways that did not take me away from my son 13 hours a day, I informed the headmaster that I would not be returning, much to his and my relief. Once I had made friends with a few of the other first-year teachers, I learned through our after-work bitch sessions that two of the men my age who had an equal degree and equal experience, were making a good $10,000 to $15,000 more than I was, had had their moving expenses paid, and had the additional perk of a living stipend to get them through the summer before payroll started. They were more shocked and surprised than I was. But I'll admit, I couldn't believe that this was still the contemporary landscape for women in the workforce. They had not asked for any of these perks or benefits. It had all been offered by the headmaster without question. After that, it took very little time for me to establish how to make money and how to help keep the family from sinking further into poverty. Not a lot of money, but more than the teaching job provided. This was in part largely thanks to my willingness to say yes to absolutely anything I was asked to do. While I wanted to stay in the art community, solely writing was not going to cut it, and baking helped, becoming a semi-stable source of income, alongside writing art features for indie rags and local papers, and waiting tables. Eventually, and as our family grew, I found that I could bake while the kids slept, or while they played on the kitchen floor, or while I fed them in their high chairs. I would eventually make all of Joseph's friends' birthday cakes, the only criterion being that they were never themed. God help me, I'll admit I tried once. I could promise my friends that any cake I made would be delicious and pretty, but I could never make them themed or cartooned. Please, God. For all the things I was good at, making a SpongeBob SquarePants figure out of fondant was not one of them. Admittedly, I was defeated by it, but I was also grossed out by it. Fondant tastes like plastic, like you're eating the sole of a shoe, like gum found under a subway seat. Having to peel a heavy drape of cornstarch and sugar off your cake is a travesty. Eating it is even more of a travesty. It's just a straight-up, unkind travesty. Out loud, I tried to stay polite and non-judgmental, and my commitment to flavor over flair seemed to be appreciated by the people around me. It was also my first indicator that I was aiming for something beyond a traditional pleasure in baking. My notebooks came back out. My trips to the library started again. I found I had ideas and standards. I was interested in, and seemingly dedicated to, finesse and beauty and classicism, hallmark traits of a pastry chef, a life and career I still had no indication I could ever call my own. Over time, I would get requests for things more refined than birthday cake for their parents' parties and holiday get-togethers. I didn't know many people my age who had a kid. All of Joseph's friends' parents were significantly older and better established than we were. They were all record producers and famous musicians married to supermodels and lawyers and Vanderbilt University scientists and doctors. They had nice houses and new clothes and beautiful furniture. They hosted cocktail parties, drank good wine. If I had a chip on my shoulder about wealthy people, those parents started to smooth the edges a bit. When I think back about how different my life was from theirs, yet how they all welcomed me and my kids into their worlds and supported us without pitying us. I remember why Nashville was such a distinct part of who I became. By and large, these were people who also didn't come from much, but worked hard to earn their way. A lot of musicians in that mix. I learned a great deal about how to foster community, no matter your status, from those people. They saw something in me, and I appreciated that. Qualities I had been waiting my whole life for someone to recognize. They saw my drive and my grit, and they liked my food, and they gave me a chance to support my family with that work. Back then, Nashville was full of people who wanted you to be your best. We did it together and supported one another. Everyone was all in if you wanted to open a taco truck, if you wanted to design Western wear, if you wanted to start a burlesque troupe, if you wanted to sell strudel out of your apartment. Let me test your salsas. Let me buy my kids' snacks from you. Let me help you build your tiny kitchen. I'll do it. Nashville was all in if you wanted to hold wine classes out of someone's living room or, say, do this crazy thing where you sell 30 seats to a dinner out of a borrowed coffee shop, an idea just starting to be called a pop-up, and cook for anyone who wanted to come. Nashville wanted you to win. And though we struggled, I had generous patrons, and I sometimes made upward of $200 a week by just making bread and pastry. And back then, even those weeks when it was only an extra $20 really helped. Besides the money, I also used this as a somewhat griftery way to keep my own family fed on the regular. I knew I could float a check at the Byright down the street from us on Belmont Boulevard over the weekend. I learned that the store made bank deposits only on early Monday and Thursday mornings. I learned this courtesy of a cashier who saw me post-dating a check and winked with her generous information. If I wrote the check late enough on a Thursday night, I could get ingredients for the orders as well as buy groceries for our house, and then would spend the weekend making all the tarts and cakes and cookies and breads for random people in our apartment building or neighborhood, sometimes making double just from the excess of ingredients for my own family. This would also allow me to feed the kids square and lovingly prepared meals without having to scrape as much as we did through the week. Come Monday, when the payments were in hand from the deliveries and the cash came in from waiting tables, I could be at the bank by 8 a.m. to make sure the check I had written on Thursday night did not bounce. We were resourceful. It was difficult, but we still did not feel desperate. We felt perfectly matched and made sense to each other, rooting each other on for our version of success and what we deemed responsibility. John was installing art at the Frist, our local art museum, and working at a frame shop across town. He was making art at night and in the early mornings, and his sculpture was a priority for us. We each dreamed big, and while I eventually became the dedicated planner and business-minded one of the two of us, not a hard one competition, really, we were simply simultaneously dedicated to not giving up on raising our family with the belief that we could actually make a living, a good, honest living, with the work we both knew we were meant to do. It was important for us to make it work, the life we knew we wanted, and it was important for us to do that work and stick to it in front of our kids and with our kids. We wanted them to know that if you worked hard enough, you could do what you were meant to do, whether it was to be a banjo picker or a writer. We did not want them to ever feel that they had to give up on the thing they loved just for money. Because money will come and go, and if you look hard enough, you can find a way to make a buck. We had seen too many people in our lives give up on the thing they were so clearly created to be, to do, solely for the big house, the promise of happiness from wealth, and the familial expectations, and most of all, because the fear was too much to live with. John and I, and our kids, to be fair, sacrificed a lot. We're willing, not to own a home, not to have new things or the best wardrobes or the nicest cars. Those all seemed like shadows of real happiness. We tried to be makers, not consumers. We wanted stability and security, of course we did, but not at the expense of being honest with ourselves. We worked hard and believed that we could have all these things because of our commitment to our work, not despite it. I was full of big, lofty ideals about what we could do. Enthusiasm for everything just poured out of me. And when Maggie started to be actively a voice in our family, to ask questions about me and the world and herself, it became exponentially more important for me to define what my life as a woman was going to be, especially to her. When the doctor announced, "It's a girl," and John Donovan fainted, I thought I might finally understand some things about women, about my own mother, things that had always escaped and confused me about the way I saw women interact within my family or in the world. But the opposite happened. I became more distanced from understanding why women do what they do to one another. When I held Maggie in my arms, looked at her face, watched her breathing, I felt nothing but unbridled hope and an urge to clear every possible hurdle for her. Having a daughter brought an immediacy to a task I'd been living for myself since I left Savannah, a focus I was leading my family with, but had not given a name to yet. She defined my spirit very quickly. We're reading from Lisa Donovan's memoir, Our Lady of Perpetual Hunger, published in 2020 by Penguin Books. Donovan is a pastry chef at the forefront of a fine dining resurgence in traditional desserts. In 2018, her culinary writing in Food & Wine magazine, where she's a regular contributor, won her a James Beard Award. I'm Susan Sweeney. Join us for more from Our Lady of Perpetual Hunger next time on Chapter a Day.